Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Amy Eddings sitting in for Brian Lehrer, and in this morning's 30 Issues in 30 Days installment, where do the presidential candidates stand on Russia and China? If it wasn't already abundantly clear before the Beijing Olympics, it certainly is now. China is on the world stage in a big way. They're one of our biggest trading partners. They hold billions of dollars worth of our debt. Their economy is still growing over 9% per year. As the U.S. becomes less dominant in the global economy, what happens to our relationship with China? And how should the next president work with the Chinese government? Joining us are James Lilly, former ambassador to China and Korea, and Robert Guest, Washington correspondent for The Economist magazine. James, Robert, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
So I will start with you, James Lilly. How has our current economic meltdown affected our relationship with China?
Well, I think according to the latest reports, the Chinese are having a reaction that the United States doesn't need to lecture us on the value of its capital markets anymore. That you have shown that your capital markets are very fragile. We have a more controlled system, and we prefer it because we keep our currency under reasonable control and we keep our stock market managed. This is not desirable from our point of view, but they look back at you and say a controlled economy with free market forces working is perhaps more suitable for us than your kind of free market capitalism.
And what was the lecture that the U.S. government was giving to China?
Well, we did go over there, and I won't name names, but we had some very high-level people go over there that understood capital markets very well and told them they had to free up their currency, they had to raise their consumption, they had to work with us on energy, oil, that sort of thing, really telling them what to do. And I don't think they really took this on board very...
They didn't take kindly to our suggestions.
Well, they say Americans are Americans. We have done very well. They admired us in many ways, tremendously, especially in the 70s and 80s and early 90s. But now it's beginning to slip as their power grows and we become a little bit more fragile.
Should we be concerned because China holds so much of our debt that does this limit our foreign policy influence with them in other areas? I just think, you know, anybody that I owe tens of billions of dollars to, I don't want to anger in any way because they could call those debts, you know, call up those debts at any time. Is that a misperception of how these debt markets work?
Well, you're partially right. They do hold over $1 trillion of foreign exchange, and a good part of that is American Treasury certificates and American bonds. But you must realize that the Chinese are very, very dependent on a vital U.S. market for their exports. They export a great deal to us. Their economy is reliant on we having a healthy economy, and they aren't likely to pull back their debts because this would lend into a crash, and they would be very badly affected and would affect their own stability. So we're joined at the hip.
We'll be taking your calls on Russia and China. What would you like to see John McCain and Barack Obama do with regard to these countries? Perhaps you're a Russian immigrant here or a Chinese immigrant, and you have some thoughts on your home country and how you would like the United States to deal with it. Give us a call at 212-433-9692, 433-WNYC. Robert Guest, I want to bring you into the conversation. From what I've been reading, neither of the candidates really seems to have taken a strong position on China. They've talked about the disagreements that the United States has had with China, and that's how they frame it, disagreements with respect to human rights abuses, the role of China in Darfur, Tibetan autonomy, intellectual property rights violations. I mean, that's quite a list there. But both Barack Obama and John McCain have continued to emphasize that we must maintain a strong relationship with China, again, because of the economic situation being tied at the hip that James Lilly referred to. Do you see, am I missing something here? Do you see strong differences between Obama and McCain?
No, Not really. I mean, I think that you have to make a distinction between what people say on the campaign trail and what they really think. And on the campaign trail, you have to play up issues which are very easy to explain to an audience that's not necessarily well-informed. And so you'll find that both candidates have come out very strongly against toxic toys that kill our children and other such sort of, you know, fantastically bold positions that nobody in the audience could possibly disagree with. The differences between them are more nuanced. I mean, I think they're both very pragmatic people. They understand that China is a given. It's there. It's very powerful. You have to engage with it. You have to trade with it. Enormous benefits can flow from that. The main difference, I think, is that Barack Obama has said a lot more about wanting to curb China's supposed unfair trade practices. He says a lot more about, for example, wanting to end, you know, tell China to stop having its currency pegged at an artificially low rate. And, you know, there's no acknowledgement in what he says that that's actually something that both helps and hinders America, and I think, you know, one should be careful what one wishes for, because if China does try to rebalance its economy and start consuming more, there'll be less that they'll be able to lend to America, and if they're not lending so much money to America, you know, where's America going to get the money from? They might, heaven forbid, have to start consuming a bit less, or maybe saving some of their own money.
I'm speaking with Robert Guest. He's a Washington correspondent with The Economist, and James Lilly, a former ambassador to China and Korea. I'm Amy Edding, sitting in for Brian Lehr. Let's step back a little bit, and James Lilly, this question is for you. Could you explain the trade deficit with China, how their currency manipulation affects trade and manufacturing in this country?
Well, first, I think you've got to look at this manipulation of the currency. Secretary Paulson has pushed them very hard on this. Senator Schumer and others have had these punitive tariffs of 27% on their goods if they don't shape up. Well, if you actually look at what's happened since 2005, their currency has appreciated, according to statistics, about 18%. But when you look at their growing productivity and their manufacturing efficiency, it drops to about 11%, which is really not very important. But they do manipulate this to get a low value on their own currency, increasing their exports and making it more difficult to export to them. However, you have to realize that American exports to China have shot way, way up. They haven't matched in any way Chinese exports to us, but they've gone up at 17-20%.
And that's because of the weak dollar, right?
Well, not so much. They're buying our goods. Weak dollar, yes, that's part of it, but also they're buying our goods. They're throwing the goods to the United States. And they've always done this for political reasons and other reasons. And our Shanghai American Chamber of Commerce, I think 70% of the people say they're making profit. And there's a sense that American businessmen are doing rather well in China. And so they are playing this game with us. On the evaluation of their currency and also on American exports and also on holding our treasury certificates. So you can't come in by slapping a very high tariff on their goods in order to shape them up. We tried to do this, you know, once. We tried to link most favored nation to human rights approval. The Chinese said, in effect, jump in a lake. We aren't going to do it. And we backed down. This is during the Clinton administration. When Reagan came in, if you talk about rhetoric during a campaign, Reagan said, we're going to restore official relations to Taiwan. The balloon went up. They were furious. I was there. I heard it. But eventually he backed away. And this guy had never met a Chinese communist before he came into office. When he left office, he'd been over there. He talked with them. Yeah, they're radishes, red on the outside, white on the inside, this sort of thing. He'd come a long way. And we'd protected our interests in Taiwan. We'd improved our relationships with China. And it seems to me that formula worked. But during the campaign, you really got the rhetoric.
Yeah. And Robert Guest, that's what you were hinting at. Behind that rhetoric, Robert, it sounds like there's really not much that Barack Obama, as much as he would like China to change its currency, it doesn't sound like Barack Obama, were he to become president, could really make many changes in that realm.
I think the main difference between the two candidates would be the extent to which they would restrain the protectionist and antagonistic instincts of some members of the U.S. Congress. We know that John McCain is a straight-down-the-line free trader, and that if Congress started putting forward sort of, you know, irresponsible ideas like let's try to slap China with huge tariffs if they don't do what we say, we know that John McCain would veto that. We don't really know that about Barack Obama. We hope he would, but he doesn't really have a track record on these issues.
Hmm. Let's take a call. Michael from Valley Stream, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. And I want you to say, in agreement with what your guest said, is that, you know, if we owe China $1 billion, you know, we have a problem. But if we owe China $1 trillion, China has the problem. As a matter of fact, we both have the problem. And if they were to recall their debt, they would bring the entire House of Cards down, and it would be a global nightmare. So they have to agree. They have to go along.
Thank you, Michael. Robert, is there a candidate that China would prefer? Do you get any sense that the Chinese are rooting for Barack Obama or John McCain?
I don't know. But I mean, I'm mostly covering the American campaign, so I perhaps wouldn't notice if there was. I don't think from the Chinese perspective there's that big a difference. I think from the American perspective there's obviously a much bigger difference. And I agree with the caller that actually it's a problem for us as well. I think, you know, if you owe China or if you owe anyone $1 trillion, you've got a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the American budget is heading for very, very serious trouble in the future, unless you can somehow spend less.
Let's talk about China's military program. James Lilly, how closely do we need to watch China's military buildup? And should we be worried that some of that firepower may be aimed at us?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. They believe in what they call asymmetrical warfare, which means they get your vulnerabilities and they take them out. They took out one of their own satellites. They know we're very dependent upon satellites for communications. They surfaced a submarine next to one of our aircraft carriers, letting them know they could break through our coverage. Yes, a lot of their work and their acquisitions are aimed at us. However, they are very, very far behind us. I think the key issue you should watch here is the arms sales to Taiwan. This is something they're very sensitive to, and you have to manage it very carefully in terms of the election in March of a democratically elected president of Taiwan who wants to have better relations with China. And that the decibel count on the Chinese attacks have dropped way off. Now, what are you going to do about arms sales to Taiwan in this kind of an improving situation? It's going to be a very tricky decision to make. And some of the acquisitions that Taiwan wants, let's say diesel-class submarines, P-3 anti-submarine aircraft, PAC-3 anti-missile, these are really not relevant to its defense. I mean, these could be taken out by China very quickly. Taiwan has to think very carefully about its real defense needs, and we should cooperate with them. But we are not the first line of defense in case China takes them on militarily. But that whole aspect...
Wait, we wouldn't be. We've made statements in support of Taiwan for quite some time. We've softened that a little bit. But you don't think that the U.S. would take that President Obama or President McCain would step into the fray were China to be more muscular and more aggressive against Taiwan?
I think there's no question that we would be part of that game. Let me go back to Bill Clinton. He came in office and he said, I'm going to link most favored nation to human rights. The Chinese said, forget it, Buster. And he backed off. But when the Chinese started having live fire exercises and firing nuclear capable missiles off the north and south coast of Taiwan, he sent in two aircraft battle groups and they backed right off. So, I mean, we have got a lot of power out there, and they know it. But we aren't going to use it if Taiwan provokes China into some sort of a rash military act, as the previous president did.
We are going to be talking about both candidates' positions towards Russia, where there has been some provocation with the breakaway republics in Georgia. Robert Guest, any sense of where the candidates stand on Taiwan and what they would do were China to act more aggressively toward Taiwan?
I think by temperament, John McCain is more of a saber rattler, more assertive militarily than Barack Obama is, and that could cut either way. I mean, you know, it could be that the perception that he's someone you don't tangle with would deter anyone, the Chinese, for example, or the Russians, from trying anything provocative. Alternatively, you know, the bad scenario is it might mean that America might actually get sucked into a conflict that it really can't afford to have. With Obama, the converse is true. You know, the danger scenario is that he would be viewed in the way that, for example, the Soviet Union saw John F. Kennedy, as this young pushover guy that meant that he could, you know, and the Russians decided to put missiles on Cuba because they thought that Kennedy wouldn't try to stop them. And the perception of weakness is almost as dangerous as weakness itself. Now, we don't quite know how the world is going to perceive Barack Obama, again, because he has no track record on these things. But we've got to hope that either way, you know, America will be able to project enough of a deterrent face to keep the peace in the region.
I'm Amy Edding, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. I'm speaking with Robert Guest. He's a Washington correspondent for The Economist, and James Lilly, the former ambassador to China and Korea. James Lilly, China just launched its third manned mission into space. It's investing billions into a space program. Is this really building up the military?
Oh, I think unquestionably. Their space program has always been run by the military. And I was down when they launched their first AsiaSat in 1990. I saw it launched. It was a perfect launch. And we were involved in it. We were helping them. This is indigenous, what they did now. They do say that space is absolutely critical to their growing security.
So should we be getting into a space race with them?
We're so far ahead of them. I don't think that is necessary right now. But our program is beginning to falter for lack of funds and certain other problems that we have. But I think we have to keep it up. But we are in a position to handle their adventures into space at this point, and we should encourage them to use it for civilian purposes more than military purposes. But they'll do their own thing. But they're selling their satellite information, their transponder information, to various countries around Asia, and it's being fairly good. The French are doing this, the British are doing it, and we're in competition.
Let's move on to energy. China and the United States are two of the biggest carbon-producing nations on Earth. Robert Guest, the Bush administration hasn't shown much leadership on this issue. Where do each of the candidates stand in terms of encouraging China to take more action and clean up its environment?
Well, I think the most important part of any package of encouraging China to do its bit is for America to do its bit. And we've not seen that over the past 8 years, but it does seem that both John McCain and Barack Obama do favor doing something about global warming. They're both in favor of a cap-and-trade system. There are some slight differences in the details, but essentially they're proposing the same idea. And if they can get that through Congress, if they can get that set up, then that gives at least some sort of moral leverage to try to get China on board. Now, the Chinese will respond that, you know, America's been polluting for much longer and is much richer, and that therefore, you know, China needs a little bit more leeway in those things. But I think there's a growing recognition that this is a global problem and it can only be dealt with globally.
And on human rights, James Lilly, we know China doesn't have the best record on human rights. Some argue that China needs to do more to leverage their power with the Sudanese government, for example, to deal with the genocide in Darfur. But you don't believe that human rights is the issue with China?
I was involved very heavily in human rights while I was there. I had a dissident in my embassy for 13 months with his wife and his son for part of the time, and I had to spend about 20% of my time getting them out, which we eventually did. We also got martial law lifted. We got amnesty for about 900 of the students at Tiananmen that were jailed. If you do that, you've got to do it the right way. You don't do it by sticking your tongue out at them or bellowing in their ear. You get it by saying, you want World Bank loans? for your own development, which they wanted very badly. You want the third yen loan package from Japan, which they wanted very badly. And you want the extension of most favored nation for you, which they wanted. If there's a trade-off there, and if we make the demands or the requests that they do something about the human rights policy, that should be done. I think, secondly, you get your law schools in there. Yale Law School, Tulane, various schools are over there, very strong. There's a lot of Chinese students coming over here studying American law. Basically, they take commercial law first, but then they look at the whole civil law program. And I think this is attractive to them.
And the feeling that you and the feeling is that they would export some of our legal terms or legal ideas about rights back to their country.
I think this is true because 50% of the Chinese faculties in China are either Western or American trained. Maybe these people don't go back pro-Western, pro-American, but it's instilled in their minds. There's another way to do things. And I think that's very important if you look at it over a long period of time, that the bridge over the Pacific is important, that the connection in law is important, that your leverage in terms of you do what you want to do and we'll do what we want to do and we'll reach a compromise and people get out.
Robert, I wanted to circle back to you before we end this conversation about China. James Lilly had mentioned that the way you work with China on human rights is not by yelling in your ear. Does that again speak to perhaps how John McCain would address human rights issues versus Barack Obama, who would be more inclined to sit down and have a talk with them about human rights?
I think certainly there's more of a danger that McCain might say something unintentionally offensive than Barack Obama. Although, on the campaign trail, that's not been true at all. I know that, Barack Obama's one of his main advisors on China, Jeffrey Bader, has written quite extensively on the importance of speaking softly, of not trying to handle your relationship through big, shouty, sort of negative sound bites, but instead by sort of quiet and patient and discreet and constructive engagement. And I think that's the way forward.
Robert Guest is the Washington correspondent for The Economist magazine. James Lilly is the former ambassador to China and Korea. Thank you for joining me on WNYC this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up, where the candidates stand with regard to Russia. Stay with us.
Russia committed serious aggression against Georgia, and Russia has now become a nation fueled by petrodollars that is basically a KGB apparatchik-run government.
Given what's happened over the last several weeks and months, our entire Russian approach has to be evaluated because a resurgent and very aggressive Russia is a threat to the peace and stability of the region.
I'm Amy Eddings in for Brian Lehrer. That was Senator McCain and Senator Obama in their foreign policy debate Friday night. We continue now with 30 Issues in 30 Days, issue number 7, China and Russia, with a look at U.S. policy toward Russia. I'm joined by Dmitry Symes, president of the Nixon Center. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
So basically a KGB apparatchik-run government, according to John McCain?
Well, there is no question that Vladimir Putin is a former KGB officer. He doesn't deny it. He is actually quite proud of it. And I also have to say that sometimes his leadership style looks like a special operation, meaning that he doesn't like always to explain what he really intends to do. He likes to be secretive. He likes to manipulate people and countries. So in this sense, John McCain is right. What are the implications of that is a very different issue.
Right, and we'll unpack that in a moment. What about Barack Obama's characterization of Russia as resurgent?
Well, again, there is no question that Russia is resurgent. In my view, it's perfectly non-controversial. You don't need to rely on Barack Obama's statements for that. Just look at statements of Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. Just today, he spoke in the Kremlin, addressed a group of senior military officers, and he said, Russia is back. Russia is prepared to defend its interests. If needed, Russia is going to use force to protect Russian interests and Russian citizens wherever they may be. That's not the way Russian leaders spoke in the past.
So how has this changed the way the United States, the current Bush administration's policy has been toward Russia?
Well, the Bush administration policy toward Russia existed on two levels. One was the level of rhetoric. President Bush, as you may remember, in 2001 in Slovenia met with President Putin, was able to look in his soul,
right,
found the soulmate, and essentially it was almost a beautiful love affair between the two presidents. But if you would look at the American practical policy, it was quite different. The United States under President Bush very quickly decided to withdraw from the ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile treaty, and the Russians were quite concerned about that. The United States pushed for a quick expansion of NATO membership, bringing three Baltic states into NATO. The United States was urging Russian neighbors to build pipelines which would be bypassing Russian territory. The United States disregarded Russian warnings not to invade Iraq. And in the case of Kosovo, the United States championed the independence of Kosovo without Serbian permission, essentially dismembering Serbia and doing this without UN mandate. So while many Americans believe that President Bush was unjustifiably friendly to Putin, if you look at the Russian narrative, it's quite different. They believe that they got a lot of friendly words, but not much else.
And we will take a look in a moment as to whether Barack Obama or John McCain would continue the Bush administration's current policies towards Russia or whether they would take a different tack. Here are two longer sections from the debate. Let's start with Barack Obama.
Their actions in Georgia were unacceptable. They were unwarranted. And at this point, it is absolutely critical for the next president to make clear that we had to follow through on our the six-point ceasefire. They have to remove themselves from South Ossetia and Abkhazia. It is absolutely important that we have a unified alliance and that we explain to the Russians that you cannot be a 21st century superpower or power and act like a 20th century dictatorship.
Barack Obama talking about the recent conflict between Russia and Georgia over Georgia's breakaway republics. Here's Senator John McCain speaking about that same issue.
I looked into Mr. Putin's eyes, and I saw three letters, a K, a G, and a B. And their aggression in Georgia is not acceptable behavior. I don't believe we're going to go back to the Cold War. I am sure that that will not happen. But I do believe that we need to bolster our friends and allies.
Again, Senator John McCain. I am speaking with Dmitry Symes, president of the Nixon Center, publisher of The National Interest. I'm Amy Edding, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. And Dmitry, I understand you have a different point of view about what happened in Georgia, certainly from John McCain, who believes that Russia was the aggressor in that conflict.
Well, it depends on your time frame. Clearly, Russia was increasing its presence in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Formally at least accepting Georgian sovereignty over these two territories. In this sense, Russia was the aggressor. But if you are talking specifically about what happened on August 8, there is no question that it were Georgian forces on orders of Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili that attacked South Ossetian capital of Tsinkvali. And they did not just do that. there was a battalion of Russian soldiers. The soldiers were part of peacekeeping brigade. They were serving there together with their Georgian counterparts. And this Russian battalion was attacked by Georgian forces. Now, this is indisputable. This is what is being confirmed by the State Department, by the CIA, by NATO intelligence. So I do not know how you define aggression. If a definition of aggression is who attacked whom, we know that the Georgian forces have attacked. Now, there were plenty of Russian provocations leading to this attack, including growing Russian military presence in South Ossetia. And Russia increased political links to South Ossetia. So clearly, the Russians were not innocent bystanders who were suddenly attacked in that situation. But if you are specific talking about a military act of aggression, the Georgians have attacked, period.
Barack Obama in that debate ended up by saying that he basically agreed with John McCain on both of their positions and approaches toward Russia. Is it a matter of which candidate emphasizes cooperation versus confrontation? Do you see substantial differences between the two?
I do, and the difference is very simple. I think that what Senator McCain says, he says with a great deal of conviction. It is his opinion. It is an opinion of his advisors. He has a long track record of being very suspicious of Putin, of being very concerned about Putin leadership actions at home and abroad. You may agree or disagree with Senator McCain, but he clearly is consistent. In the case of Senator Obama, my impression is that he did not give a great deal of thought to this issue. I followed carefully statements by his advisors, and they are quite divided on who have attacked whom in Georgia, what is more important, Russian actions preceding Georgian attack or the Georgian attack. And clearly quite a few of his advisors were saying that what happened in South Ossetia was sufficiently complex, not really to warrant a tough American response, taking into account that this was a very particular situation and that the United States has other important interests vis-a-vis Russia. My impression is that Senator Obama at the end decided to listen to his political advisors, campaign advisors, who persuaded him that the Georgian issue was not the one where he wants to fight Senator McCain. So he essentially kind of agreed with McCain, not as a matter of conviction, not as a result of some kind of analysis, but because it was an effective campaign technique.
Well, so do you think that when the two candidates, when they get into office, do you think that how they will deal with Russia would change? For example, with Barack Obama, if he's doing this just as a political campaign ploy now, how would his position toward Russia change if he were to become president? And does this behind-the-scenes battle between his advisors give you a little window into what might happen under a Barack administration, you know, some sort of confusion over Russia or some muddling middle road?
I think that anyone who follows Russian developments would start with an agreement that Russia is an authoritarian country. They talk about sovereign democracy, but the style of government is much more sovereign than democratic. Russia is also is increasingly assertive with its neighbors. It is prepared to use force. It is prepared to use Russian energy resources as political leverage. It is clearly not an easy country to deal with. The question is not whether we want to have a love affair with Russia and to give Mr. Putin some kind of reward for his democratic achievements. Nobody is suggesting anything like that. The real question is, do we want to offer Russia some kind of quid pro quo in return for things we need from Russia: cooperation on non-proliferation, counter-terrorism, energy security? Or would we prefer to essentially open a new front against Russia, in addition to Iraq, in addition to Afghanistan, to have a military confrontation in the Transcaucasus. This is a real issue for both presidential candidates. I think that Mr. Obama is more inclined to be cautious, is more inclined to ask questions about unintended consequences of U.S. actions, not to support the Russian conduct, but to ask questions about American interests and priorities before deciding how to proceed. What? Senator McCain essentially saying the United States is right, and accordingly we should find a way to punish Russia. But whether he would behave this way if he becomes president, that is an interesting question, because Senator McCain has his preferences, but when you are in the Oval Office, the reality often takes over.
Would John McCain's idea of a League of Democracies not include Russia?
Oh, I'm sure that it would not include Russia, and I'm sure it would not include China.
And how would that inflame, how would that help or hurt a relationship with Russia?
Well, the question is what this League of Democracies is going to do. If it is going to be essentially a discussion club, if it would be a place where democracies try to coordinate their policies, I don't see a great deal of harm being done to U.S. dialogue with Russia or with China. But if we would decide that the League of Democracies would a kind of supplement the UN Security Council, and the League of Democracy would be prepared to take unilateral military action without UN authorization. I think that that has a potential of pushing Russia and China closer to each other and may lead to a global realignment against American interests.
Both candidates pointed to energy independence as a counterweight to Russia. What's our vulnerability to Russian energy supplies?
Well, I think it's perfectly appropriate to be less dependent upon Russian energy supplies, particularly if we're talking about Europe, where in some countries like in Germany, 60% of their gas consumption in Germany comes from Russia. And clearly this gives Russia an unacceptable leverage. On the other hand, the problem is that we need Russian energy, as we need energy from other countries, if we want to have adequate energy supplies and if we want to control energy prices. So what we need to do is to try to have a balanced policy, which on one hand would allow us to build pipelines from Central Asian nations, which would bypass Russia. But at the same time, we don't want to suppress Russian energy production because we need every barrel of oil anyone can produce. It is in the American interest, not just in the Russian interest.
And Dmitry Symes, we need to wrap this up, and our conversation continues online at WNYC.org. Click on the Brian Lehrer Show and post a comment on our comment page. But I wanted to end this discussion by talking about the Ukraine and Georgia's entrance into NATO and the United States' support of that effort that clearly antagonizes Russia. Where do we go from here, though, with both candidates basically supporting Ukraine and I'm blanking on the other one, their inclusion, Georgia, into NATO?
Well, I think that if you're talking about Barack Obama, he supports Georgian and Ukrainian membership in NATO, but he doesn't say that they immediately should get so-called MAP, Membership Action Plan, which would allow both nations a kind of accelerated path to NATO membership. Let me start with Georgia. I don't see how you can invite Georgia to join NATO as long as Georgia demands control of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. These two territories are independent from Georgia now. They have Russian troops stationed. And according to the NATO Charter, nations at first should resolve their territorial disputes. And only then they can be invited to join NATO. I don't see how we can, in good conscience, invite Georgia to join NATO unless we are prepared to go to war with Russia over Abkhazia and South Ossetia. So I don't see how Georgia can be put on this path to membership at this point.
And we have to wrap it up there. Dmitry Symes is president of the Nixon Center, publisher of The National Interest. The depth and breadth of your knowledge on this is really astounding. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Nice being with you. Bye-bye.
Coming up, your calls on how the financial crisis is affecting you directly. Give us a call at 212-433-9692 to share how Wall Street is affecting your street.